This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Return of the Native by Thomas Hardy. Book 2, The Arrival. 4. Eustacia is led on to an adventure. In the evening of this last day of expectation, which was the 23rd of December, Eustacia was at home alone. She had passed the recent hour in lamenting over a rumour newly come to her ears that Yobright's visit to his mother was to be of short duration, and would end some time the next week. "Naturally," she said to herself, "a man in the full swing of his activities in a gay city could not afford to linger long on Egdon Heath." That she would behold face to face the owner of the awakening voice within the limits of such a holiday was most unlikely, unless she were to haunt the environs of his mother's house like a robin, to do which was difficult and unseemly. The customary expedient of provincial girls and men in such circumstances is church-going. In an ordinary village or country town, one can safely calculate that either on Christmas Day or the Sunday contiguous, any native home for the holidays who has not through age or ennui lost the appetite for seeing and being seen will turn up in some pew or other, shining with hope, self-consciousness, and new clothes. Thus the congregation on Christmas morning is mostly a tussaud collection of celebrities who have been born in the neighbourhood. Hither the mistress, left neglected at home all the year, can steal and observe the development of the returned lover, who has forgotten her, and think, as she watches him over her prayer-book, that he may throb with a renewed fidelity when novelties have lost their charm. And hither a comparatively recent settler, like Eustacia, may betake herself to scrutinize the person of a native son who left home before her advent upon the scene, and consider if the friendship of his parents be worth cultivating during his next absence, in order to secure a knowledge of him on his next return. But these tender schemes were not feasible among the scattered inhabitants of Egdon Heath. In name they were parishioners, but virtually they belonged to no parish at all. People who came to these few isolated houses to keep Christmas with their friends remained in their friends' chimney corners, drinking mead and other comforting liquors, till they left again for good and all. Rain, snow, ice, mud, everywhere around, they did not care to trudge 2 or 3 miles to sit wet-footed and splashed to the nape of their necks among those who, though in some measure neighbours, lived close to the church and entered it clean and dry. Eustacia knew that it was 10 to 1 that Clem Yobright would go to no church at all during his few days of leave, and that it would be a waste of labour for her to go driving the pony and gig over a bad road in hope to see him there. It was dusk, and she was sitting by the fire in the dining-room or hall, which they occupied at this time of the year in preference to the parlour because of its large hearth, constructed for turf fires, a fuel the captain was partial to in the winter season. The only visible articles in the room were those on the window-sill, which showed their shapes against the low sky, the middle article being the old hourglass, and the other two a pair of ancient British urns which had been dug from a barrow near, and were used as flower-pots for 2 razor-leaved cactuses. Somebody knocked at the door. The servant was out, so was her grandfather. The person, after waiting a minute, came in and tapped at the door of the room. "Who's there?" said Eustacia. "Please, Captain Voy, will you let us—" Eustacia arose and went to the door. "I cannot allow you to come in so boldly. You should have waited." "Oh, the captain said I might come in without any fuss," was answered in a lad's pleasant voice.
"Oh, did he?" said Eustacia more gently.
"What do you want, Charlie?"
"Please will your grandfather lend us his fuel-house to try over our parts in tonight at 7 o'clock.
"What, are you one of the Egdon mummers for this year?"
"Yes, miss. The captain used to let the old mummers practice here."
"I know it. Yes, you may use the fuel-house if you like," said Eustacia languidly. The choice of Captain Vye's fuel-house as the scene of rehearsal was dictated by the fact that his dwelling was nearly in the centre of the heath. The fuel-house was as roomy as a barn, and was a most desirable place for such a purpose. The lads who formed the company of players lived at different scattered points around, and by meeting in this spot, the distances to be traversed by all the comers would be about equally proportioned. For mummers and mumming, Eustacia had the greatest contempt. The mummers themselves were not afflicted with any such feeling for their art, though at the same time they were not enthusiastic. A traditional pastime is to be distinguished from a mere revival in no more striking feature than in this, that while in the revival all is excitement and fervour, the survival is carried on with a stolidity and absence of stir, which sets one wondering why a thing that is done so perfunctorily should be kept up at all. Like Balaam and other unwilling prophets, the agents seem moved by an inner compulsion to say and do their allotted parts, whether they will or no. This unweeting manner of performance is the true ring by which, in this refurbishing age, a fossilized survival may be known from a spurious reproduction. The piece was the well-known play of St. George, and all who were behind the scenes assisted in the preparations, including the women of each household. Without the cooperation of sisters and sweethearts, the dresses were likely to be a failure. But, on the other hand, this class of assistance was not without its drawbacks. The girls could never be brought to respect tradition in designing and decorating the armour. They insisted on attaching loops and bows of silk and velvet in any situation pleasing to their taste. Gorget, gusset, bassinet, cuirass, gauntlet, sleeve, all alike in the view of these feminine eyes, were practicable spaces whereon to sew scraps of fluttering colour. It might be that Joe, who fought on the side of Christendom, had a sweetheart, and that Jim, who fought on the side of the Muslim, had one likewise. During the making of the costumes, it would come to the knowledge of Joe's sweetheart that Jim's was putting brilliant silk scallops at the bottom of her lover's surcoat, in addition to the ribbons of the visor, the bars of which being invariably formed of coloured strips about 1/2 inch wide, hanging before the face, were mostly of that material. Joe's sweetheart straightway placed brilliant silk on the scallops of the hem in question, and, going a little further, added ribbon tufts to the shoulder pieces. Jim's, not to be outdone, would affix bows and rosettes everywhere. The result was that in the end the valiant soldier of the Christian army was distinguished by no peculiarity of accoutrement from the Turkish knight, and what was worse, on a casual view, St. George himself might be mistaken for his deadly enemy, the Saracen. The guisers themselves, though inwardly regretting this confusion of persons, could not afford to offend those by whose assistance they so largely profited, and the innovations were allowed to stand. There was, it's true, a limit to this tendency to uniformity. The leech, or doctor, preserved his character intact. His darker habiliments, peculiar hat, and the bottle of physic slung under his arm could never be mistaken, and the same might be said of the conventional figure of Father Christmas, with his gigantic club, an older man who accompanied the band as general protector in long night journeys from parish to parish, and was bearer of the purse. 7 o'clock, the hour of the rehearsal, came round, and in a short time Eustacia could hear voices in the fuel house. To dissipate in some trifling measure her abiding sense of the murkiness of human life, she went to the lean-hay, or lean-to shed, which formed the root store of their dwelling and abutted on the fuel house. Here was a small rough hole in the mud wall, originally made for pigeons, through which the interior of the next shed could be viewed. A light came from it now, and Eustacia stepped upon a stool to look in upon the scene. On a ledge in the fuel house stood 3 tall rushlights, and by the light of them 7 or 8 lads were marching about, haranguing and confusing each other in endeavours to perfect themselves in the play. Humphrey and Sam, the furs and turf-cutters, were there looking on. So also was Timothy Fairway, who leant against the wall and prompted the boys from memory, interspersing among the set words remarks and anecdotes of the superior days when he and others were the Egdon mummers elect that these lads were now.
"Well, ye be as well up to it as ever ye will be," he said.
"Not that such mummin would have passed in our time. Harry is the Saracen. You should strut a bit more, and John needn't holler his inside out. Beyond that, perhaps you'll do. Have you got all your clothes ready?"
"We shall by Monday."
"Your first outing will be Monday night, I suppose?"
"Yes, at Mrs. Yobright's."
"Oh, ho, ho, Mrs. Yobright's. What makes her want to see ye?"
"I should think a middle-aged woman was tired of mummin'."
"She's got up a bit of a party, because 'tis the first Christmas that her son Clem has been home for a long time."
"Oh, to be sure, her party. I'm going myself. I almost forgot it, upon my life."
Eustacia's face flagged. There was to be a party at the Yobrights. She, naturally, had nothing to do with it. She was a stranger to all such local gatherings, and had always held them as scarcely appertaining to her sphere. But had she been going, what an opportunity would have been afforded her of seeing the man whose influence was penetrating her like summer sun. To increase that influence was coveted excitement. To cast it off might be to regain serenity. To leave it as it stood was tantalizing. The lads and men prepared to leave the premises, and Eustacia returned to her fireside. She was immersed in thought, but not for long. In a few minutes the lad Charlie, who had come to ask permission to use the place, returned with the key to the kitchen. Eustacia heard him, and opening the door into the passage, said, "Charlie, come here." The lad was surprised. He entered the front room not without blushing, for he, like many, had felt the power of this girl's face and form. She pointed to a seat by the fire, and entered the other side of the chimney corner herself. It could be seen in her face that whatever motive she might have had in asking the youth indoors would soon appear.
"Which part do you play, Charlie? The Turkish knight, do you not?" inquired the beauty, looking across the smoke of the fire to him on the other side.
"Yes, miss, the Turkish knight," he replied diffidently.
Is yours a long part?
Ooh, 9 speeches, about.
Can you repeat them to me?
If so, I should like to hear them.
The lad smiled into the glowing turf and began,
Here come I, a Turkish knight, who learnt in Turkish land to fight.
Continuing the discourse throughout the scenes to the concluding catastrophe of his fall by the hand of Saint George. Eustacia had occasionally heard the part recited before. When the lad ended, she began precisely in the same words and ranted on without hitch or divergence till she too reached the end. It was the same thing, yet how different! Like in form, it had the added softness and finish of a Raffaele after Perugino, which, while faithfully reproducing the original subject, entirely distances the original art. Charlie's eyes rounded with surprise.
"Well, you be a clever lady," he said in admiration.
"I've been 3 weeks learning mine."
"I have heard it before," she quietly observed. "Now, would you do anything to please me, Charlie?"
"Oh, I'd do a good deal, miss."
"Would you let me play your part for one night?"
Oh, miss, but you're a woman's gown, you couldn't."
"I can get boys' clothes, at least all that would be wanted besides the mumming dress." "What should I have to give you to lend me your things, to let me take your place for an hour or two on Monday night, and on no account to say a word about who or what I am? You would, of course, have to excuse yourself from playing that night, and to say that somebody, a cousin of Miss Vi's, would act for you. The other mummers have never spoken to me in their lives, so that it would be safe enough, and if it were not, I should not mind. Now, what must I give you to agree to this?"
"Half a crown?"
The youth shook his head.
5 shillings?
He shook his head again.
Money won't do it," he said,
brushing the iron head of the fire dog with the hollow of his hand.
"What will then, Charlie?" said Eustacia in a disappointed tone.
"You know what you forbade me at the maypoling, miss," murmured the lad, without looking at her and still stroking the fire dog's head.
"Yes," said Eustacia, with a little more hauteur. "You wanted to join hands with me in the ring, if I recollect."
"Half an hour of that, and I'll agree, miss."
Eustacia regarded the youth steadfastly. He was 3 years younger than herself, but apparently not backward for his age.
"Half an hour of what?" she said, though she guessed what.
"Holding your hand in mine."
She was silent.
"Make it 1/4 hour, she said.
"Yes, Miss Eustacia, I will, if I may kiss it too. 1/4 hour, and I'll swear to do the best I can to let you take my place without anybody knowing."
"Don't you think somebody might know your tongue, miss?"
"It is possible, but I will put a pebble in my mouth to make it less likely."
"Very well, you shall be allowed to have my hand as soon as you bring the dress and your sword and staff. I don't want you any longer now."
Charlie departed, and Eustacia felt more and more interest in life. Here was something to do, here was someone to see, and a charmingly adventurous way to see him.
"Ha, ha," she said to herself, "want of an object to live for, that's all is the matter with me."
Eustacia's manner was, as a rule, of a slumberous sort, her passions being of the massive rather than the vivacious kind. But when aroused, she would make a dash which, just for the time, was not unlike the move of a naturally lively person. On the question of recognition, she was somewhat indifferent. By the acting lads themselves, she was not likely to be known. With the guests who might be assembled,
she was hardly so secure, yet detection, after all, would be no such dreadful thing. The fact only could be detected, her true motive, never. It would be instantly set down as the passing freak of a girl whose ways were already considered singular. That she was doing for an earnest reason what would most naturally be done in jest was, at any rate, a safe secret. The next evening Eustacia stood punctually at the fuel-house door, waiting for the dusk, which was to bring Charlie with the trappings. Her grandfather was at home tonight, and she would be unable to ask her confederate indoors. He appeared on the dark ridge of heathland, bearing the articles with him, and came up breathless with his walk.
"Here are the things," he whispered, placing them upon the threshold. And now, Miss Eustacia?"
"The payment. It is quite ready. I am as good as my word." She leant against the doorpost and gave him her hand. Charlie took it in both his own, with a tenderness beyond description, unless it was like that of a child holding a captured sparrow.
"Why, there's a glove on it," he said, in a deprecating way.
"I have been walking," she observed.
"But, miss—well,
it is hardly fair." She pulled off the glove and gave him her bare hand. They stood together, minute after minute, without further speech, each looking at the blackening scene, and each thinking his and her own thoughts.
I think I won't use it all up tonight, said Charlie devotedly, when 6 or 8 minutes had been passed by him caressing her hand. "May I have the other few minutes another time?"
"As you like," said she, without the least emotion. "But it must be over in a week. Now, there is only one thing I want you to do, to wait while I put on the dress, and then to see if I do my part properly. But let me look first indoors."
She vanished for a minute or two and went in. Her grandfather was safely asleep in his chair.
"Now then," she said, on returning, "walk down the garden a little way, and when I am ready I'll call you."
Charlie walked and waited, and presently heard a soft whistle. He returned to the fuel-house door.
"Did you whistle, Miss Foy?"
"Yes, come in,"
reached him in Eustacia's voice, from a back quarter.
"I must not strike a light till the door is shut, or it may be seen shining. Push your hat into the hole through to the wash-house, if you can feel your way across."
Charlie did as commanded, and she struck the light, revealing herself to be changed in sex, brilliant in colours, and armed from top to toe. Perhaps she quailed a little under Charlie's vigorous gaze, but whether any shyness at her male attire appeared upon her countenance could not be seen by reason of the strips of ribbon which used to cover the face in mumming costumes representing the barred visor of the medieval helmet.
"It fits pretty well," she said, looking down at the white overalls, "except that the tunic, or whatever you call it, is long in the sleeve. The bottom of the overalls I can turn up inside. Now, pay attention."
Eustacia then proceeded in her delivery, striking the sword against the staff or lance at the minatory phrases in the orthodox mumming manner, and strutting up and down. Charlie seasoned his admiration with criticism of the gentlest kind, for the touch of Eustacia's hand yet remained with him.
"And now, for your excuse to the others," she said, "where do you meet before you go to Mrs. Yobright's?"
"We thought of meeting here, miss, if you have nothing to say against it. At 8 o'clock, so as to get there by 9.
"Yes, well, you, of course, must not appear. I will march in about 5 minutes late, ready-dressed, and tell them that you can't come. I have decided that the best plan will be for you to be sent somewhere by me to make a real thing of the excuse. Our two heath-croppers are in the habit of straying into the meads, and tomorrow evening you can go and see if they are gone there. I'll manage the rest. Now you may leave me.
Yes, miss, but I think I'll have 1 minute more of what I am owed, if you don't mind.
Eustacia gave him her hand as before.
1 minute, she said,
and counted on till she reached 7 or 8 minutes. Hand and person she then withdrew to a distance of several feet, and recovered some of her old dignity. The contract completed, she raised between them a barrier impenetrable as a wall.
"Oh, there, 'tis all gone, and I didn't mean quite all," he said with a sigh. "You had good measure," said she, turning away.
"Yes, miss, well, 'tis over, and now I'll get home along." End of chapter 4.